especially Louis and friends and Alex Butchel for having me here. It's of course also a pleasure to come back to PI where I did one of my postdocs. I'm really happy for that. So what I want to discuss today is what are the solutions that are associated with the superradiant process, with the superradiant instability, both in charged black holes and in rotating black holes. And this is based on work that I have done, on a series of works that I have done with George Santos that is here, Gary Arovitz, Paul Figueras, Shiraz, Minoala, Prahar Mitra, Ricardo Monteiro, Harvey Real, and Harvey Real.
Oscar, as a next PI member, you should know that you should use the office
paper. Oh, yeah. It's too heavy for me. Sorry. So I will start by recalling some properties associated with super ratings. I will not be too much detailed here since Vitor will give a detailed talk about these issues just after me. So that will give me an opportunity to jump immediately to the rest of my talk, and I will have some extra time to discuss those topics. Then I will focus on charged super ratings, and I will tell you that at the onset of the charged super ratings of scalar charged super ratings on the Reisner-Nordström black hole, we have a bifurcation curve in a phase diagram to a new family of airy black holes that have a scalar field orbitating around the central black hole. Then I will also discuss that these black holes that we will construct are probably associated with the endpoint of the charged scalar superradiance. And then I will move to the probably more interesting case of rotating superradiance. Again, I will construct the black holes that bifurcate at the onset of the superradiant curve in a phase diagram. These black holes have the nice property that they have a single Killing field that is also the horizon generator of these black holes. And here the story concerning the time evolution of the rotating superradiance will be different from the charged one. And in particular, I will tell you that we don't know much about what is the endpoint. And I will tell you that it would be very interesting to have to study the time evolution of this system to understand what is going on with rotating systems. So let me quickly recall that when we have superradiant scattering on a rotating or charged black hole, what happens is that we send a wave. If this wave has a frequency that is smaller than the m, which is the angular momentum, the quantum azimuthal angular momentum of the wave times the angular velocity of the black hole, or if in the case that black hole is rotating, or when the frequency of the wave is smaller than the scalar charge of the wave times the chemical potential of the charged black hole, then the wave, after entering the ergo region of the black hole, can be amplified. Okay? And now the interesting thing is that if on top of this I have some kind of mirror in my system, I know that this amplified wave will reflect at the mirror and will come back, will be amplified again, and will keep doing this a long time. And of course, this will lead to an instability. Now, what could be the natural mirror? Vitor will discuss these kind of systems in very detail. In this talk, I'm interested in the case where my mirror is a very natural mirror that is present when we have an ADS background. So this, I will work with systems that live, that asymptotically are global ADS. And in these kind of systems, we have a confining box that provides me these reflecting boundary conditions. And now, what I really want to address in this talk is that associated with this instability, at the onset of this instability, like in other instabilities, it is quite often the case that at the onset of the instability, we have a bifurcation to new solutions that are different from the original family where the instability is present. And I want to construct those solutions. But before doing that, let me also have a transparency that is related with superradiance, but not closely related with what I will discuss next. But this is an opportunity given the audience. I think that you might have some interest on this, on this transparency that I have here. So, and this concerns the microscopic description of superradiance. Of course, we know what I've been talking up to now is about superradiant scattering. And superradiant scattering can be seen as a stimulated emission process because I'm sending some wave injecting some wave in the system. In this sense, it is stimulated. But semi-classically, we know that there is also spontaneous superradiant emission. And actually, this spontaneous superradiant emission is entangled with Hawking thermal radiation. And it is extremely difficult to disentangle both of them. Of course, Hawking radiation, the Hawking radiation spectrum is thermal. The superradiant emission spectrum, we know very well what it is. It is only for frequencies that are smaller than a certain cutoff. But anyway, it's difficult to disentangle these two systems. Now, what we found together with Roberto Impara and Alessandro Macaroni is that it is possible in certain systems to isolate superradiance from Hawking emission. And in order to do that, what we need to have is an extremal, non-BPS, but extremal, rotating black hole. Because it is extremal, it is at zero temperature, so we are sure that there is no Hawking radiation. But because it is rotating, it might well have an ergo region. And so we have what we call an ergo-cooled black hole. So if you want a particular example where this happens, we can take the D1D5P system. So one of the solutions, one of the extremal solutions of this system is the BPS BMPV black hole. But there is a second extremal solution that is what we call the ergo-cooled black hole. It is also at zero temperature, but it has an ergo region, as opposed to the BMPV black hole that has no ergo region. And so this is the right setup to try to isolate and study superradiance. Now, rotation in the supergravity solution corresponds to fermionic excitations charged under the R symmetry group in the CFT. This D1D5P system has a decoupling geometry that is ADS3. This ADS3 is dual to a two-dimensional CFT. This two-dimensional CFT lives on this effective long string that I'm representing here. Now, what we found is that in this effective string, we have left moving and right moving excitations. Now, it can be the case when we are in this situation where we are at zero temperature, but we have an ergo region. What we find is that the left sector can be arbitrary. It is thermally excited. It is the one that is giving the entropy to the system. But we can also have the right moving sector that is at zero temperature and zero entropy. So it has no bosonic excitations. When it collides with the left mover, it will not emit any Hawking radiation. However, it is polarized with fermions that are filling the energy levels up to the Fermi level. Okay, and when these two open strings collide, they can form a closed string with R charge that is emitted to the bulk and that we realize macroscopically as superradiant emission. Now, this is the spontaneous superradiant emission process. Then if you want to look to the superradiant scattering, what we have to do is to do the net balance between the superradiant emission and the absorption process as required by thermal balance. And what we find is that we can have, for example, in a situation like this where the left sector is thermally excited arbitrarily, we can have one of these fermions from the left sector that collides with one of the fermions from the right sector, and it emits the closed string to the bulk. But if we are really on top of superradiance, because of the Pauli exclusion principle, we cannot have the absorption, the complementary process, where we would have an extra fermion with spin plus one off that would fill the right sector below with an energy below the Fermi level. Okay, the other good thing is that we have quantitatively recovered the superradiant bound. So omega must be smaller than m times capital omega.
And do you also get, you reproduce the classical amplification? So if you take the classical geometry, you scatter a wave off of it, you get the same amplification. Can you reproduce the amplification?
So, and in particular, you want to see the time scales and so on.
Yeah.
No, the point is that in order to do this, notice that we must be really on top, on the marginal mode, on top of the onset of superradiance in order to study this, because we want to isolate this from Hawking radiation. So once the process begins, immediately you are driven away from extremality, you know, and Hawking radiation will also turn off. So this is something that we cannot reproduce.
Okay.
with this setup. You know, but the super radiant bond, which is a unique characteristic of super radiance, we can reproduce quantitatively, which I find it's quite good. Okay, so let me go to the bulk of my talk. So what do I want to do first? First, I want to study charged super radiance. So what I will do is that I will take Einstein-Maxwell gravity in an ADS background. I want to study solutions that are globally ADS. And I will add a charged massless scalar field. The scalar field could have mass, but in the simplest case, I will just turn off the mass. However, this scalar field has a certain scalar charge that I will call E. And this scalar charge, of course, contributes to the covariant, to the gauge covariant derivative that appears in my action. So I have here Einstein gravity. Here I have the ADS cosmological constant term. I'm setting L to 1 here, Maxwell term, and then the kinetic term for the charge scalar field. I'm interested in looking for static and spherically symmetric solutions. And I expect to have a three-parameter family that is characterized by the mass, the charge of the black hole, and the scalar charge of the scalar field. The ansatz for our solutions is this one written here. Notice that here I have a, so I'm working for in five dimensions. We could do this in other dimensions. So here I have the S3. So my the horizons of my black hole will have a horizon topology of a sphere. And then I have here two functions that depend only on the radial coordinate. Then I have a Maxwell field, a radial Maxwell field, and a scalar field. Of course, what do I know? Do I want? I want to find, if possible, all possible static solutions of this theorem. I know very well one of them. It's the ADS Reissner-Nordström black hole with spherical horizons, where the energy and the charge is given as a function of the horizon radius and the chemical potential of the solution. For this solution, what happens, of course, is that the scalar field is turned off, and these two functions are the same, or they, well, actually, they should not be the same. They should be the inverse of each other. And this family, and this function f depends on the horizon radius and on the chemical potential of the solution. Now, quite importantly for what I will discuss next, this solution has a regular extremal limit where the temperature goes to zero, but the entropy is kept constant. Is kept constant? No, it's kept finite. And quite important in this extremal limit, the solution has a near horizon geometry that has an ADS2 factor there. So it's ADS2 cross S3. And so the Reissner-Nordström black holes exist when the chemical potential is between zero and the upper bound, where this upper bound gives me extremality and is a function of the horizon radius. Okay, so what do I want? I know this solution. I want to know what other possible solutions could be out there and construct them. So, quite often, a good strategy to find solutions, new solutions, is to look to one that we already know, the Reissner-Nordström, and ask if the if it has instabilities. Because when it has instabilities, it could be the case that the, at the onset of the instability, we have a bifurcation to a new family of black holes, of solutions. And Reissner-Nordström, we know very well that it has at least two instabilities. One is the superradiant instability that I don't have to discuss much more. So when, if the frequency is smaller than the scalar charge time chemical potential, since I'm in global ADS, the system will be driven unstable due to the multiple superradiant amplification and reflections at the boundary. And now the question that interests us here, because I want to have some notion, I want to understand what is what will be the parameter space of our solutions. So I want some quantitative guide for that, in order to do some search after for solutions, is whether we can estimate the instability onset. And we can indeed. In order to do that, let's look at small black holes, so where the horizon radius is much less than the ADS radius. And if this is the case, I know that the frequencies, the scalar frequencies that can propagate in this small black hole are certainly very close to the normal mode frequencies of global ADS that are in ADS units, they are given by 4 plus 2p, where p is the number of zeros along the radial direction. For the rest of this talk, I will set p equals to zero. This will be the solution with the lowest energy, but we could repeat everything with the p turned on. On the other hand, recall from the last transparency that extremal black holes must have an upper bound on, or have a have a definite chemical potential. And when I send the radius to zero in the previous expression, if I send the horizon radius to zero in this limit, I know that chemical potential is square root of 3 over 2. Now, if I plug this in the super radiant condition, I get this condition here. And basically what this condition tells me is that small extreme horizon Arsenic black holes are super radiant unstable if the scalar charge in ADS units is bigger than square root of 32 over 2. Okay? However, Ryson-Arsam, and probably this is not so well known for some of us, Ryson-Arsam has a second instability that is completely different in nature from the super radiant instability. Although they will join forces to drive Ryson-Arsam unstable. So they will be present in the system at the same time, in a time evolution. And this is what we call the near horizon scaling condensation instability that was first observed in the context of the holographic superconductor studies in planar Ryson-Arsam black holes. Planar. Here we are talking about spherical Ryson-Arsam black holes.
So you didn't have a mass for the scalar?
I didn't have a mass for the scalar, but I have a Maxwell field and a scalar charge in the scalar. That will provide me an effective mass, as we will see. Okay, so first let me forget for a moment Ryson-Arsam, the case that I'm looking at in particular, and let me discuss this instability in general backgrounds. So what we want to do is to take a charge. This will be important. Massive scalar field that satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation. We want to look to normalizable modes that have finite energy, so we know that these modes must satisfy the mass of the mode of the scalar mode must satisfy the BF bound, which is basically a negative number that is proportional to the dimension of the spacetime divided by the ADS radius, the five-dimensional ADS radius. And now the key point is that any, and the word any is really very important here, any extreme ADS black hole that has a near horizon geometry that contains an ADS2 factor with radius that I will call LADS2, that is different from the full geometry radius, as itself a BF bound. The near horizon geometry as itself a bound associated with this ADS2 factor. And this bound is precisely minus 1 over 4 in ADS2 radius units, and certainly differs from this BF bound. And now you see what can happen. If the mass of my scalar field is greater than the BF bound, the full geometry BF bound, as it is required to be a normalizable mode, but it is smaller than the two-dimensional near horizon BF bound, what this tells us is that the asymptotic geometry space is stable to this scalar condensation, let's say, but the near horizon geometry will be unstable. And this is a clear indication that the black hole itself should be unstable to the scalar condensation of scalar field. This is not a proof, but is a strong suggestion. Now, this was confirmed in this paper here, where, and this is very important, that then I would like to emphasize this. This is something that happens for any black hole that has an extreme configuration with an ADS2 near horizon geometry. This includes, of course, the planar Ryson-Arsam black holes that are dual to holographic superconductors, and this is the place where this near horizon scalar condensation instability was first found by Gubson. But it also includes, and this is not so well known, rotating black holes that can be or not charged as long as they have an extreme configuration. And quite surprisingly, actually, it also includes static black holes that do not rotate and have no charge. And here I'm thinking on the hyperbolic Schwarzschild ADS black hole that has hyperbolic horizon topology. Because this black hole also has an extreme configuration as opposed to other Schwarzschild black holes.
I'm confused. So with this instability, you would compensate the scalar field and use sort of like cloud of scalar around the black hole. But this only happens in ADS.
Yes.
So, but if your horizon radius is much smaller than the ADS radius, then locally it looks flat. So where does the ADS-ness come in, and why is it not present in asymptotic flat?
It is not present clearly in the ADS. You know, no matter how small it is, the point is that once you turn it off, you have this BF bound. you know, and it really makes a difference whether you have it turned on or not, the ADS.
I understand mathematically, but physically.
Physically, you want to understand why a very small black hole that doesn't see the ADS scale will suffer from this instability.
Because locally it would look flat to me.
Well, can I add something? No. The incidentally flat case does have something that you could call this phenomenon.
Which is? What?
Which is the mass exploded field instability.
Yes.
You have bound states in there for mass exploded.
But I thought that in the incidentally flat case, you had, you know, the usual Mohair theorems where, you know, you couldn't allow such.
So, but probably what happens in that case is that that instability is present, but it happens something like what Shibata told us yesterday. You have an instability in the Myers-Perry black hole, the Bar-Mode instability, you know, that makes the black hole move to another member of the family that just has smaller energy and smaller angular momentum. You know, so what could be in this entire flat case is that you have this kind of instability, but a longer time evolution, it will not bifurcate you to any new solution. What it will do is that it will make the black hole become neutral, you know? It will discharge some of the black hole.
If you send the ADS radius to infinity, the mass, to infinity the mass...
Or here? Yes, goes to zero, yeah. Well, and this all this disappears, right? This goes to zero, this interval.
Well, there,
so you should not have this. So I agree with it. That's what I started. I said that any ADS black hole, that's where this is present. But this question makes sense, you know. If the black hole is extremely small, you don't see the ADS.
Yeah, because ADS has to do with a boundary, right? There's certain electrons. That's what Steve
mentioned. But the important part is that minus sign. You wouldn't, if you were in asymptotically flat space, you wouldn't be thinking about a tachyonic field. And so when it does condense, it's going to, the cloud is going to expand out until it realizes it's in ADS space, and then it's going to decide, oh, I'm stable.
Okay, and it stays there, or it will move in another direction.
Can I just
but why does it decide that it's stable? That's my question. I mean, because
then it decides. No, no. But then it decides. When it gets to the ADS scale, it realizes it's in ADS space.
It will be
so in flat space. It would just
well. I think. I think at least in part of the parameter space, the flat space counterpart is still here, and you do have a flat space counterpart.
So what you're saying is that in the what you are saying is that in the flat case, if you have the Maxwell field,
yes.
You will also have an effective mass that is given by E squared times the Maxwell field squared.
So can I just add one comment? There's two types of instabilities. I think there's the near horizon. This will only be present in ADS, and then there's a super ADS instability. The super ADS instability also has an associated onset to a new parameter family of solutions, and in four-dimensional curve. These solutions do exist. And they evade stuff like the like the Mohair theorem because they have only one killing field.
I will talk about
first,
that.
They're not physical because you perturb them and they will just radiate away the, but they do exist as stationary solutions with respect to this killing field.
Yeah, well, so then we're back again to the near horizon. Why is the near horizon instability present in ADS?
Because of what
Paul said. Yeah. That's what you like. You know, in a time evolution, it will decide whether then it will settle down into one of these area black holes that I will construct or whether it will come back to vice versa. Okay, so let me come back to the particular setup system that I'm studying, which is spherical Reissner-Nordström ADS or global ADS Reissner-Nordström. And remember that we decided to start with a massless scalar. So in principle, this game should not be present here. However, if we study linearized Klein-Gordon equation for a charge scalar in the near horizon Reissner-Nordström ADS, we will find that this Klein-Gordon equation reduces to the equation of a massive scalar with an effective mass that in ADS 2 units is given by this expression here. That depends on the horizon radius of the black hole and depends on the scalar charge of the black hole, and of course on the ADS radius of the full five-dimensional geometry. Now you might be wondering, I start with a massless scalar, or can I have an effective mass? Remember that our Klein-Gordon equation is the Klein-Gordon equation for a charge scalar, so here what you have is the gauge covariant derivative that includes a term that is the scalar charge times the Maxwell field. And when you take the box of this, you will have a term that is minus e squared a squared. and this provides you an effective mass. And actually, this is what Gupsa told us in his study of this instability in the planar Weissenhorsten black hole. Now, remember, in ADS2, we have a two-dimensional BF bond that in ADS2 radius units is simply minus 1 over 4. And now, if the effective mass of my system is below this BF bond, then I have an instability. Okay? And this tells me that extreme Weissenhorsten black holes will be unstable to the near horizon instability if the scalar charge is bigger than this right-hand side. Okay? Now, this right-hand side is a monotonically decreasing function of the horizon radius. And when r goes to very large, this reduces to 3 plus corrections in 1 over r squared. So what this is telling us is that large, because I'm sending here r to infinity, large extreme Weissenhorsten black holes are unstable when e squared, when the scalar charge is bigger than square root of 3. Okay? Now, it's quite important to emphasize that the nature, this should already be clear because this is involving BF bounds. The super radiant instability doesn't involve at all BF bounds. But anyway, it's here we can also emphasize that this near horizon instability is completely different in nature from the super radiant instability. And one way to see this is that when we send r to zero, the horizon radius to zero in this case, remember that in the previous case, we found that small extreme Weissenhorsten black holes are unstable to super radiant instability when the scalar charge is bigger than square root of 32 over 2. Here, if we send r to 0 to have very small extreme black holes, we find that the condition for instability, for the near horizon instability, would require the scalar charge to go to infinity. This is also a quantitative way of seeing that the two instabilities are really different in nature. Okay, so what have we learned so far? Weissenhorsten ADS black holes in global ADS are apparently stable, at least to the super radiant and near horizon stability, if the scalar charge is smaller than square root of 3. Very large extreme black holes are unstable to the near horizon stability if E is bigger than square root of 3. And arbitrarily small extreme black holes are super radiant and stable if their scalar charge is bigger than square root of 32 over 3. Now, we have done a linear instability analysis of zero modes to see the onset of these two instabilities and to confirm that these heuristic computations are indeed correct. So what I'm plotting here is the charge of the Weissenhorsten black hole as a function of the mass of the Weissenhorsten black hole. Actually, here and in the next plots, what I will always plot is delta m, where delta m is the mass of the black hole of the solution with respect to the mass of the extreme Weissenhorsten black hole that has the same charge as the solution we are looking at, just because this will make the plots more visible, more clear. And so here, what do we find? What we are plotting here are the critical, the minimum scalar charge above which the Weissenhorsten black hole is unstable. And what we find is that for a given horizon radius, the minimum value of the scalar charge always occurs for extreme black holes. These are the black holes that live here when delta m is equal to 0. We also find that this minimum value of the scalar charge decreases monotonically from square root of 32 over 3 to square root of 3 as the black hole size grows, which is compatible with what we found from the heuristic arguments. Apparently, or at least to We don't find any instability if the scalar charge is smaller than square root of 3. And all extreme black holes above the scalar charge are unstable.
A question. I think I asked. So if the scalar field satisfies the extremal bound, is the geometry unstable? If the field itself satisfies the bound that the charge over the mass is smaller than what you have for the extremal geometry, do you still have instability?
So what you are asking me, here I'm starting with a scalar, here the answer here is yes, right? Because here I'm starting with a field that has scalar mass is equals to zero, and it has a charge. So it has charge that is bigger than its mass.
Well, that's the other way around. Yeah, my question is the other way around.
If it does, you turn off the charge, and you just look at an equal to an extremal black hole, uncharged, just rotating, and we'll find the same thing.
the super radiant instability at least should be there, you know? The near horizon, it might not be there, but the super radiant should be there. Okay. Now, quite important for our numerical search that comes next is that here I will assume that the area of black holes that I'm assuming that exist and that I will search for will bifurcate from the Ryson-Arson family precisely at the onset of these instabilities. And now I have windows in the parameter space where I should focus my search. So I know that I should have at least three windows. One is when scalar charge is smaller than square root of 3, when it is between square root of 3 and square root of 32 over 3, and when it is above square root of 32 over 3. So I should look to these three different windows. And let me go right away. I will present the results. In the second part of this talk, I will discuss the rotating case. In the rotating case, I will give you some extra details concerning boundary conditions, concerning the way we generate these solutions. But in order to have an opportunity to discuss both systems, in this case, let me go straight away to the physical results that are the most interesting ones. So let's start with a regime where the scalar charge is smaller than square root of 3. What I'm plotting here is the same that I plotted in the previous figure. So charge of the black hole, or of our solution, sorry, versus the mass of the solutions that are measured with respect to the extremal Ryson-Arson black hole with the same charge. So extremal Ryson-Arson black holes are this horizontal line at zero. And what we know is that this shaded yellowish area is the region where Ryson-Arson ADS black holes live. Now, we learned in the previous transparency that this Ryson-Arson black hole is stable, apparently. So we don't expect any bifurcation to new black hole solutions. However, we do find another family of solutions in this case. But it is not a black hole. It is a soliton. So it is a regular solution, but with no horizon at all. It is regular at the origin, and it approaches global ADS at infinity. And this is what I'm drawing here in this black line. So what is quite important here is that, first, this curve, this soliton curve, has a Chandrasekhar limit. So it has an upper bound in the charge and mass that it can have. So you can think that here the intuition that can fail, as we will see next, but here the intuition is that if there is something along the lines that you were trying to discuss, is that if the charge is too much big, the repulsion will not allow the system to stabilize, will not allow gravity to balance the electromagnetic repulsion. The other thing is that as we move along this line, forget for a moment the red line, as we move along this black line, what we see is that the GTT component of the metric is decreasing, is decreasing, of course. And the curvature invariant is growing. And precisely at the cap, where we have the Chandrasekhar limit, in principle, of course, this is extremely difficult to see numerically, but the Kretschmann invariant should be blowing up. We see it growing really very large. Now, the other interesting thing is that this has a series of cusps. So probably it's a series of infinite cusps. So, although, of course, numerically, again, we can just see a few of them. We can just see this one and this one. The solution is perfectly regular at each one of these cusps, like in the black ring where the fat and the thin ring meet. Now, the other interesting thing that is that these cusps can be observed as, depending on the quantities that we are plotting, they will manifest themselves as damped oscillations or spiraling curves. So, for example, if I plot the charge of the soliton as a function of the GTT component of the metric evaluated at the origin, what we see is that as we move along this line, at a certain point we start seeing oscillations. And if instead I plot the amplitude of the scalar field at infinity as a function of the charge of the solution, what I will see is this spiraling behavior. Again, with several arms. Okay, I think that, what is the red curve? So we have done this, we have constructed these solutions in two ways at least. One was a full nonlinear construction of the solutions using a numerical code. And the other one was doing a perturbative construction of the solution, an analytical perturbative construction of the solution. The red curves here are precisely the perturbative results that are valid for small charges only. And what we see is that in the regime of small charges, where the perturbative results are expected to be good, we see that they agree quite well with the numerical results, which is a good check of our numerics. Here, the same thing. However, very important thing, notice that at this point, the perturbative results go crazy. We cannot trust them anymore, for sure. And quite importantly, notice that the perturbative results would never see the interesting physics that is going on at large charges. So they could never see these cusps, they could never see these oscillations or these spirals here. So this shows is a good example to show us that numerics can be really important to learn about physics.
The Venturan curve at like say 0.02
this
still
one?
Is not, yeah, that part is still not seen.
No, because you know it comes from a place where the charge was already large. So what you are saying is that here the charges would be small.
So
I would not say.
Solution.
Actually, I would say that you should trust this corner if you prefer. If you should not even trust this one, if you want. You are already stretching it too much. So this is good just to give you the slope, let's say. Okay?
So this scalar field is stationary, right? It's got some time dependence?
This scalar field, we are working in a gauge where we are setting omega equals to zero. The frequency is equal to zero. That's why I'm calling it a soliton and not a boson star. Okay? But you could do a gauge transformation and work in the frequency would be precisely M times kept, it would be precisely the super radiant bond. You can go do a gauge transformation where the frequency is E times the chemical potential.
The only difference is that here there's a gauge field. So you can perform a gauge transformation to get rid of the phase.
Yeah. You have to play with both the scalar field and the Maxwell field.
So each of those points is a different solution, right?
Yes, indeed.
So if there's that type of zigzagging, which you can't really see in the plot, but you can see on the blackboard.
So say it again?
The zigzag.
Ah, the zigzag. Well, you can see it slightly here. And also there is a second one.
Doesn't that mean the solution is not unique?
This means that the solution is not unique, exactly. If you give a given charge, there are two possible solutions, or three.
So what happens dynamically then?
Sorry?
What would happen dynamically? I mean, clearly you can't.
What we do know is that in principle, that's what we know from studies in boson stars where people study the stability of the solutions. For example, I'm thinking on Astfanzai and Radu. What they do find at, you know, for static boson stars is that up to the cusp, the solution seems to be stable. After the first cusp, they develop an instability. Okay?
Can I be the devil's advocate in that question? This is not really non-uniqueness, because for one value of the charge and one value of the mass, you only have one solution.
Yeah, I know.
There's no third exit in this case.
Yeah. So if I don't have...
I didn't get that. But
if I give you...
If I look at that thing you draw over there,
yes,
I can clearly draw a vertical line.
Yeah, but then if you also specify the mass, what he's saying, if you specify
charge.
Both the charge and the mass, there is only one solution.
That's
the
mass of the black hole.
It's of soliton. We will see later. I will give you an example where you explicitly see non-uniqueness in the sense that you give both the mass and the charge of the black hole, and you have more than one solution because they will have different entropies. This is the honest definition of non-uniqueness.
I see. So this is really unique.
Yes, if you specify both, sorry for that comment. If you specify only the charge, you would have two different masses. But if you specify also the mass, and when you refer to non-uniqueness, you are thinking on specifying both the mass and the charge, and then you see if the solution is the same or you have different ones.
But you mentioned some boson star study where those other branches were unstable. Where do those, when the instability sets in, can you... Where does it want to go? Does it want to go to the lower branch, or does it want to do something?
They just studied the linear instability, and they just did a linear instability analysis. They didn't do a time evolution analysis. So I don't remember exactly the details, but I don't think that they can tell from just the linear instability analysis what will happen in a time evolution of the system.
I don't think it can go to the other one because you're working at fixed energy. The other ones have lower energy.
Well, an asymptotic flat, radiates. I don't know what ADS.
But in ADS, how do you get rid of the energy?
Hair.
Hair inside the hair.
Well, some radiation, there's no horizon.
But one thing, the usual thing is with those cusps, at each cusp, you pick up another unstable node, so you get successively.
Yeah, it becomes more and more.
That's, I mean, they could have predicted that from the turning point method, right?
That, exactly. They use actually catastrophe theory.
Yeah,
that which is
so
what
the digital linear instability analysis, or they use the turning point method?
Oh, no, no, they use the turning point, which is, I would No, I don't think they did really, you know, they didn't run a code. Do you remember? I don't think they ran the code to look for the linear instability analysis. I don't think, I think it was just, but I would say that this is the equivalent of, in the sense that it doesn't tell us more about the time evolution than the linear instability
analysis. If you have the linear instability analysis, then that can tell you something about where it wants to go, right? Because you see how the solution is.
Think only in terms of the ultra-spinning instability, for example. You have a linear analysis and it tells you nothing whether the new solutions, for example, to where the black hole can go, the a time evolution can take you, whether it, they have, you know, they go to the right or to the left of the Myers-Perry curve.
Yeah, but you see what it's doing.
You know, you have,
unstable modes and
okay, you can see, for example, the, if they are axisymmetric, you know, you expect new solutions to preserve the same symmetries as the unstable mode, that's true.
So you can describe which type of analysis you do?
Yeah, we'll discuss it in the rotating case, you know, if or else I will not have time to discuss both.
Can you put a black hole in something with this as well?
A black hole? Yeah, no. For this scalar charge, no. For scalar charge above this one, I can. I will tell you this. That's what I tell you next. Okay?
How do you know the black hole goes to this?
No. I'm not saying that the black hole will go to this. I'm just showing you. This is not a time evolution. This is a phase diagram of static.
Before you said though that the extreme black hole was unstable to forming a solid.
But not in this, not for this range of energies. You know, I'm just telling you that the soliton. You know, we are interested on airy black holes that bifurcate from the Ryson-Norsen at the onset of the instability. You know, but since we are working with this, let's look to all possible solutions, and we find that there is also this soliton. And the soliton, you know, as you see here, it's more, actually, it's more massive than the extremal Ryson-Norsen with the same charge. Next, you will see that it can have lower mass, so they are not connected. Okay, just another solution. Okay, let me move to the next window of parameters. So when the scalar charge is between, so the square of it is between 3 and 32 over 3. Again, I'm plotting exactly the same quantities. Charge of the black hole versus delta M. Here we have the extremal Ryson-Norsen black holes. These are the yellow part is the Ryson-Norsen solution. Here I have the, so let me start by telling you what the black curve here. The black curve is the soliton branch. It has more basically the same properties as the one that I discussed previously. The only difference that you can find here eventually is that the other soliton was always above the, for the same charge, it was always more massive than the extremal Ryson-Norsen with the same charge. Here, there is a critical charge where it goes below.
And this curve never crosses the R1?
In
the previous plot, the R curve that was going this, now this one is goes positive and then it comes down, they don't cross, right? So one is into the
R1. You remember that? But we are working with different scalar charge.
You're asking if that black curve ever touches which one?
The previous one. That is for a different charge, this
no,
one.
No, I think it always starts going down like this.
Yeah, we don't, look, look at the scale of the problem. You know, here it's 10 orders of magnitude.
They have different slopes, and the slope starts moving slowly.
Yeah, no, but here it's not good. Okay, the next thing, okay, we also have the cusps, we have a Chandrasekhar limit. That's okay, nothing new compared with the previous one. Now, what is more interesting is that now, we know that Ryson-Norsen black holes, at least the large, extremal Ryson-Norsen black holes, should be unstable. And indeed, this is what we find here in this red curve. This red curve is the onset of the instability as found using a linear code. Okay? And what we find is that Ryson-Norsen black holes are unstable as long as they have a charge that is above a critical number. So we don't find small black holes, unstable black holes.
Sorry, you said you got using a linear code. A linear code that does what?
The linear code finds you the onset where the frequency is zero, is the marginal mode of the charge superradiance instability. Okay? Now, this is good. It's good that we have this linear code because this linear code gives us, no doubt, the onset of the instability. On the other hand, we have a non-linear code that is producing all these blue dots, or if you want, all this blue area. What is this blue area? This blue area represents black holes, airy black holes, that have a scalar field outside of the horizon also. And this is constructed using a non-linear code, and it's very nice that these lines, these vertical lines, let me call them like this, are lines where the epsilon, the amplitude of the scalar field at infinity, is changing. So when you go from here to there, the amplitude of the scalar field is growing, but you are keeping the horizon radius constant. And it's very nice to see that when you send the scalar amplitude to zero, you precisely meet the red curve from the linear code that was obtained independently. So this is a good check to the nonlinear code. The other thing that we have here is these horizontal lines, blue lines. They are curves at constant horizon. They are curves at constant scalar amplitude. But here I'm changing the horizon radius. So the horizon radius is decreasing as I move to the left. And what we do find is that there is an extremal configuration here where the temperature is going to zero. So this will be the extremal limit of our airy black holes. Now, this extremal limit of the airy black holes clearly are not the solitons. So the solitons don't appear as the zero size limit of the extremal airy black holes. Okay. And what is happening with this extremal line of airy black holes is that the temperature is going to zero and the Kretschmann invariant is exploding at a finite radius. Okay? So this suggests that the lower bound for a given charge, the lower bound of the airy black holes will be an extremal singular solution, not connected at all with the solitons. Okay? So here what I'm drawing, you know, here this more continuous dotted curve, blue curve, is again a curve at constant horizon radius. That is the closest one that we could reach to the extremal singular solution.
So that's a good singularity.
It's a bad singularity.
No,
it's good.
It's good.
These
what
are the ones
good?
That in some limits.
Good in the sense of the
good,
the bad, and the negative.
The low temperature limit. I mean, if you take the original Hartnell Horowitz model at low temperature,
okay.
That's singular.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, in some limit, that's where this singularity goes.
Okay.
So yeah, a bit more subtle than that, as the next slide will show
really?
Up. Yes, a tiny bit.
Okay.
Things can get more messy. I think I said everything that I wanted to say. Okay, so let me move to the third window of parameter, in the parameter space, when the scalar charge is above. One thing that I would like here probably stress is that, look, the fact that we don't find airy black holes with small charge is consistent, again, with heuristics that we had in the beginning. We know that small extremal black holes are superradiantly unstable only when the scalar charge is above 32 over 3, but here it is below, okay? And now, if we move to the case where the scalar charge is above 32 over 3, then what happens is, what we have here. Again, Bryson-Orson black holes, the red curve is the curve at the onset of the superradiance instability from the linear code. The blue lines, these lines are lines at constant horizon radius where I'm increasing, when I move down, I'm increasing the scalar amplitude. The scalar amplitude, when it goes to zero, we really hit the red curve from the linear code. These curves here are curves at constant scalar amplitude where the horizon radius is decreasing. What is new here? To start with, we do find black holes that are arbitrarily small, airy black holes that are arbitrarily small. The next interesting thing is that depending on what is the value of the charge, so if the charge is smaller than a critical value, the soliton is the zero size limit of the airy black hole. However, if we are above, and clearly we see this here, if we are above a certain critical charge, it is no longer true that the soliton is the zero size limit of the black hole. So here we have a situation like the previous one, this is new. We have a soliton that is being the zero size limit of the area black hole. So let me be a little bit more specific about this solution. So in the case where you are in for small charges, what is happening is that the temperature is diverging as you approach the soliton. This is what we are seeing here in this red curve, for example, or the purple one. And you can understand this divergence of the temperature. Of course, the soliton has no temperature because it has no horizon. And what this branch of solutions, you can think on them. I don't know who asked me just this. You can think on them as putting a small Reisner-Ostern black hole on top of a soliton. And I know that the Reisner-Ostern black hole, the temperature blows up when the horizon radius goes to zero, which is what is happening here. I'm sending the horizon radius to zero. So it's not a surprise that the temperature is diverging. However, above the critical charge, what happens is that the temperature is going to zero and the Kretschmann is blowing up. So again, we have a good singularity like in the previous case for these ones. And it was quite a surprise for us that there was this transition here. A really big surprise. And we can also find it using the perturbative analysis. So it's.
Does that mean you perturb the solitons and there's some marginal deformation?
You can construct the area black hole as a small perturbation. Using a leading order thermodynamic argument, you can find the area black hole as a small perturbation where you put the Reisner-Ostern on top of the soliton. But you can also do a perturbation where you do just an expansion in terms of the horizon radius, and as a double expansion in the horizon radius of the solution and the scalar amplitude of the scalar field. The soliton, you can construct it perturbatively just by doing an expansion in the scalar amplitude. Again, I will give you some details in the case of the area black hole, how this expansion is done.
Do you see something funny happening to the soliton as you approach?
That's a critical point.
Yes.
It's very difficult to see, but one thing, that critical point can be predicted using perturbation theory. You bring that point close to the origin. You can predict this using perturbation theory, and it matches remarkably well our results. So that point, that seems very non-analytic, right?
This is a good singularity. So this is something that corresponds to having some degrees of freedom, some internal degrees of freedom, which carry some entropy that you cannot see at the level of superiority, but this seems to be then coming from the soliton, this degrees of freedom. So the soliton must be doing something funny close to that point.
But you have to be a little bit careful. I don't know if Oskar will put this in the next slide. There is another branch of solitons.
I will.
Okay.
I will. Let me just add before moving that around this critical point, what you see in these curves as you approach the extremal configuration is that the temperature oscillates many times before going either to infinity or to zero. That's the only thing that I would like to add. Now, actually, the story is slightly more complicated in what concerns solitons. And actually, this is something that we didn't observe in our studies. It was just after Mukund Rangamani spoke with one of us that we got aware of this. Because so far, what I showed you for small scalar charges, for example, this one, so when it is below 32 over 3, what I showed you is that the solitons have an upper bound in the air charge. But actually, if you really search more carefully, what you will find is that there is a second branch of solitons. So what I represented so far was this branch of solitons that as a cutoff, doesn't exist for very large values of the scalar of the charges, but there is a second branch that is not connected to this one. If you are below 32 over 3, that can extend to arbitrary large charges. And what happens when you increase the scalar charge and you go above 32 over 3 is that these two branches connect to each other. Okay? If I plot this in terms of M and Q, what I'm saying, for example, in this plot, what I'm saying is that besides this branch, where you have something like this, there is a second branch that goes like this. Probably it would go something like this. Or whatever.
This is the branch that eventually connects.
Okay. And what is funny is that as you approach square root of 32 over 3, what is happening is that this gap is getting closer and closer and closer. Well, after 32 over 3, it really connects, and that's what I'm showing here, right? It's this one. It goes up to very large charges. But there is an extra, but I will not go into the details. But actually, when it connects in such a way that, let me repeat this figure, but for the case where you are above 32 over 3, it does connect something like this, but then you also have some loops.
Some balls that form outside.
This is something that was studied in great detail over there. Yeah.
These are another branch of solutions that just does not connect to this one. And they sometimes they form loops, sometimes they extend. It's a complete
mess.
You mean
when they form loops in the
parameter space.
In the parameter space.
Yeah. Five, for example.
Scalar field nodes, it's really weird.
After Mukund told us about their results, we confirmed that in our case we also see this.
Yeah,
but
they were the first ones
to
find it. We didn't search.
Yeah, and that's where they. If you go to their paper, you can see all these.
The reason I'm asking about this is because I'm interested in giving you kind of an entry point to a microscopic understanding of this system, because it looks like these solitons at some point they start giving you the possibility of having sufficient entropy first to give you a good singularity and then maybe what.
So they are the food.
It's a bit like in the fastball story, but I don't think that in the fastball story there's anything like this point where you go from something that
as far as
it's a solidon and then you enter the branch of the small black hole.
But this is an artificial Lagrangian, because if you are in the supersymmetric case, you can do the supersymmetric case, which we are doing now, and then things are more close to the fastball proposal.
Yes, let me now at this point move,
yes.
Or else I will not have time to talk about the rotating system. So, one thing that I have not told you yet is that the entropy of all our airy black holes is always bigger than the entropy of the Reissner-Nordström ADS black hole with the same charges. Okay? So, for fixed scalar charge, the airy black holes should be the endpoint of charge super radius.
Sorry, Oscar, can I just ask you one quick question?
Mm.
With the solitons that were unstable because you've gone around this cusp, could the end state not just be a non-extreme or Reissner-Nordström ADS solution? That's presumably what the end state is, right?
So you are saying in this situation, for example?
Further back, there was a question about where the unstable solitons went if they decayed. Wouldn't they just decay to non-extreme or Reissner-Nordström ADS?
Either through a nonlinear process
through a linear.
So that's my
question. I see, so there's no
classics,
there's no mystery.
Okay, because the airy black holes always have an entropy bigger than the Reissner-Nordström ADS entropy, we have here a similar story like in the Gregula-Flamm system. So it could well be the case that the endpoint of charge super radius is precisely one of the airy black holes that we have just constructed. But of course, to confirm this, what we would like to have is a full-time evolution of the system to confirm this. Now, one question that you might immediately raise is that, okay, let's suppose in a time evolution it could well be that these airy black holes form at a certain point, but then couldn't they be just metastable states? That is, shouldn't we expect them to be also superradiant and stable and then decay to something else? And we believe that the answer here is no, because these black holes, these airy black holes always have also a chemical potential that is always smaller than the chemical potential of the corresponding Reissner-Nordström ADS black hole with the same charge. And this is clearly seen here. The chemical potential that is plotted in this vertical axis is always below the Reissner-Nordström ADS chemical potential. So the superradiant modes no longer fit inside ADS. What I'm saying here is that the real part of the quasi-normal modes in these airy black holes never satisfies the superradiant condition. It's always above the critical value for instability.
But could there be another type of instability not connected at all to super radiance that will take you off?
Of course. We are doing what we can do.
No,
again, we need this. Again, we need this.
What are you fixing when you compare that?
So here I'm plotting. Here I'm plotting the chemical potential as a function of the charges of the, and I'm fixing the scalar amplitude of the field. Okay, guys, let me move to the next topic, which is I want to address now rotating superradiant, a system that has a rotating superradiant instability. What I want to do is to work with Einstein AdS gravity in five dimensions that is minimally coupled to what we call a doublet. That is just a complex massless scalar field. You will understand soon why I need a doublet to do technically our computations. So I have just pure Einstein gravity in AdS with a kinetic term for the doublet, for our doublet. And again, what I want to look is to look for boson stars and airy black hole solutions that satisfy these ansatz. The ansatz for the gravitational field is this one. The ansatz for the doublet that has two components is this one. Let me start by explaining why we choose this ansatz. So this ansatz, the important thing here is that we have three functions, f, g, and h, that are, four functions and omega, that are functions only of the radial coordinate. So this is a codimension one ansatz. All I need to know is four functions that are functions of the radial coordinate. On top of that, I also need to know this pi function that gives me the scalar field that is also only a function of the radial direction. Where does the motivation for this ansatz comes from? Because again, this theory, when I send the doublet to zero, the scalar field to zero, has one solution that is very well known. And in that case, what I have is the scalar field is zero, and this g function is just the inverse of the h function that appears there. And in this case, this describes me the Myers-Perry black hole with equipolar angular momentum in five dimensions. And it has squashed, you know, if I work at a constant T and R surfaces, what I have is a squashed S3 horizon that you can see that is, in the end of the day, is just CP1, the complexity projective space, and that you can see as a S1 bundle over S2. And the angular momentum is along the direction parameterized by phi. So when looking to the airy black holes, the only thing that I'm doing is that I'm introducing a new function in my ansatz, and this will be enough to find our airy black holes. Okay? Okay, the other thing that is important is, again, the strategy to find, to have some idea of what kind of black holes I could have in my system, new black holes, is that I should look to instabilities of this black hole. And in particular, I should look to the superradiant instability. And what I'm plotting here is precisely the information about the superradiant, the onset of the superradiant instability in this black hole. So I'm plotting the angular velocity of the horizon as a function of the horizon radius. This blue curve is the curve where you have the extreme Myers-Perry black holes. They exist below the blue curve. And what I have here, the red curve, is the curve where the Myers-Perry black hole is unstable, is marginally unstable to superradiant modes with m equals to 1. So all Myers-Perry black holes above this line are unstable to m equals to 1 superradiant modes. But of course, I can have other azimuthal quantum numbers. Here I have the onset of the m equals to 2 superradiant instability. All these black holes are unstable. And I could keep doing an infinite tower of lines that would approach, as m goes to infinity, would approach the value of omega equals to 1. Okay? And now, our idea is that we want to focus on this curve that gives me the m equals 1 instability is the strongest one. And I want to focus, and again, like in the previous example, we have the belief that this will be a bifurcation curve to a new family of hairy black holes that rotate. And we want to construct these black holes. Okay? Let me say something else. Okay. Note for future reference, notice that the entropy is proportional, of course, to the horizon radius associated with the S2. But it is also proportional to square root of h. That is associated with the radius of the S1 that sits there. Okay, what are boson stars? Boson stars are solutions that have this harmonic time dependence, E2 omega t. Notice that since I'm working with m equals to 1, I'm setting here m equals to 1 where we have there phi. In general, this would be m phi. Okay? There is here a strange combination of thetas and phi. This is peaked, you know, fine-tuned peak in order to do something that we will see next, that I will explain next. Okay, let me look at the isometries of the solution. So remember that the symmetry of the solution must leave all fields of the solution invariant, not just the gravitational field. So it must leave the metric, but also the scalar field invariant. Now, the gravitational field has five linear independent Killing vectors. The time translation, the Killing field that generates time translations that generates the rotations along the phi direction and the three rotations along the S2. However, the only linear combination of these fields that leaves the doublet invariant, the doublet vector invariant, is a sum of dt plus omega d phi, where omega is the frequency of the scalar field. So this is the only Killing vector field that the airy black hole solutions will have. The only one. It's a solution with a single Killing vector field, something that, if we can construct them, as I will show that we can, is something that we had not seen in the past. Now, moreover, this Killing vector, I will show this in more detail, is null at the horizon. So it's all a Killing horizon generator. It's the only Killing field that we have, and it is generating the horizon. So what I'm saying is that these solutions that we'll construct are not time symmetric, because this is not a Killing vector, and they are not axisymmetric. But they are stationary in the sense that they have a Killing vector field, and they are periodic in time. Okay, after a certain period, we always see the same thing. Now, the first question that you might raise is whether this is not contradicting the rigidity theorems, because what these rigidity theorems tell us is that stationary black holes must always be axisymmetric. And remember the assumptions of this theory, of this theorem. It assumes the existence of a stationary Killing vector field that is dt, and then it also assumes that it is not normal to the horizon, and it uses these assumptions to prove that then we must have a second Killing vector field that is generating the rotations along the phi direction responsible for axisymmetry. Now, the reason why these black holes are not violating this theorem is because these black holes that we are constructing do not fall inside the assumptions of the theorem. Because we have a single Killing vector field, our stationary Killing vector field is a single one, and it is normal to the horizon, because it is generating the horizon. So the theorem doesn't apply. These airy black holes do not violate.
But is the horizon geometry not axisymmetric?
So sorry?
Is the space-time not axisymmetric?
So the metric itself. The metric itself is axisymmetric.
Isn't that I would say that would be part of the geometry. It's
sorry?
Axisymmetric horizon.
Yeah, but you can take the same thing, take a geon, put a small black hole in the middle, the it's no longer axisymmetric, the metric, and it's the exact same procedure.
But these ones are axisymmetric, the horizon.
The gravitational field only, yes, but you have to look to the full field content of the solution.
The matter is not axisymmetric.
And this is really important. You cannot say that just because one field has that isometry, the full solution
is. For the GM, right?
Actually, in the end, would I have the case? I don't think I will have the case, but in the end, would I have the case? I would precisely construct the airy black holes associated with the airy gravitational area.
I would think rigidity is property of the geometry. So you've got some structure at the horizon. What does it say about the geometry? And
This is, as I was saying, a toy model.
Right. It's really
guys, let me move or else I will not be able to finish, really. Sorry. So something that I have not explained to you is why I picked that particular ansatz for the scalar, for the doublet, this funny ansatz here. And the reason why we picked this one, actually it was not us, this was first observed by these people here. What they observed is that with this ansatz for the doublet, if you work with a doublet scalar instead of a single scalar field, and if this doublet has this particular ansatz, although it depends on the polar directions, theta and phi, what happens is that when you plug it in the energy momentum tensor on the right-hand side of your Einstein equations, the several terms in your energy momentum tensor conspire in such a way that all the theta and phi dependence, well, the phi dependence is not a surprise, but all the theta dependence cancels. So your energy momentum tensor only depends on the radial direction. And this is the reason why you can have a metric field being sourced by a scalar field that has the metric has more symmetry than the source itself. And this plays really an important role in our construction because like this, we just have a codimension one problem to solve.
Why do you need a doublet for that?
To cancel these thetas. If you don't have the thetas, you know, if you don't have the thetas, if you don't have a doublet, your TAB will always depend on theta. Okay? So there are out there other airy black holes with a standard scalar field. It's just more difficult to construct them. This this is. Okay? Okay, let me discuss boundary conditions. So now I will give you some more details that I did not give in the other case. So asymptotically, both the boson star and the black hole, the area of black holes, we want them to asymptote to global ADS. So it means that, for example, the function f goes to 1 plus r squared over l squared. The other ones go to 1. And the next two leading order terms that are proportional to these coefficients, Cf, Ch, C, C omega, they will give us information about the energy and the angular momentum of the solution. So, for example, the energy and the angular momentum are given by this combination associated with those coefficients. Now, in what concerns the scalar field, the doublet, we want it to be normalizable. It is a massless scalar field, so this means that it has to go as 1 over r to the fourth. And I have here the asymptotic amplitude of our scalar field, of our condensate, that I will use to plot some things in the future. Now, the Wiener boundary condition, of course, it depends on whether we are looking to the boson star or to the black hole. Boson star are smooth solutions without an horizon. The only thing that we want to require is that they are regular at the origin. The only detail here that I should emphasize is that this being regular, in order for this doublet vector to be regular at the origin, it must go linearly with R. Now, in the case of the black hole, the Wiener boundary is the horizon. I will take, as a definition of my horizon radius, the point where the function f goes to 0. And at the horizon, I want 5 minutes. No, it was 10:30, you told me.
No.
It was
1 hour.
Yeah. We're back from the coin break.
Okay. Oh, okay. Now you tell me. Okay. I should also say that the equations of motion, when you evaluate them at the horizon, they tell us that the frequency of the scalar field must be equal to the angular velocity of the horizon. This is a very important point. They are constrained like this. Black holes should satisfy the first law of thermodynamics. Boson stars also have the first law of thermodynamics. Now, properties of this single Killing vector field. It is null at the horizon, as I just told you. Now, it's just outside the horizon or the origin. It is time-like in a certain neighborhood. And as it goes at infinity, it can be asymptotically time-like, null, or space-like, depending on whether omega L is smaller, equal, or bigger than 1. Now, quite importantly, all the area black holes that we will construct have omega L bigger than 1. We really try to construct something that has omega L less than 1, the reason being that those would be stable to the superradiant instability, but we cannot find them. Okay? So the solution, of course, this Killing vector is not globally stationary because of this. It is time-like just outside the horizon, but not everywhere. Okay, now I should not go through the perturbative construction. That would be very interesting. Numerical method. I mean, we are using the standard relaxation Newton-Raphson method with spectral discretization. This is a detail. You know, there is a residual gauge freedom that we discussed already before in the case of the charge system that we can play with that helps us constructing the solution. So in certain regions of the parameter space, it is better to work with the physical gauge where the angular velocity at infinity is 0. But sometimes it's good to go to the other gauge where omega, the frequency, is equal to 0. We use the first law and the perturbative construction that I didn't discuss as checks also to the numerics. Now, quite non-trivially, again, the nonlinear code that is generating the area of black holes is giving me in the limit where the amplitude, the scalar amplitude, goes to 0, is precisely matching the instability, the onset instability curve of the superradiant instability that I showed you in some transparencies above. And not only this is a consistent check of the numerics, but more importantly, this is what allows us to physically make the contact to tell us that these area black holes that we are constructing, they are really associated with the onset of the superradiant instability. They merge with the Myers-Perry black holes there. I should say that for large energy and angular momentum, the scalar amplitude or the frequency of the boson star, they do not uniquely specify the solution. What uniquely specifies the solution is the derivative of the scalar field, or if you want, the kinetic energy of the scalar field at the origin. And what we see here is the damped oscillations that we already saw in the charge case. For the scalar amplitude, for the frequency, the energy and the angular momentum have similar curves. Here the red curve is the perturbative result. So again, we see that there is a good match where it is supposed to have, but then the perturbative construction completely misses the physics for larger charges. In the case of the black hole, the two quantities that naively could parameterize the solution are the scalar amplitude and the horizon radius, but we find that, like in the soliton, they do not specify an Euclidean solution. So what we use to parameterize the solution is the radius of the S2 and the radius of the S1. And let me give the results. I just have two transparencies. So let me start by looking at small charges. So here I'm plotting the energy as a function of the angular momentum. What I have here in purple is the boson star. What I have here in blue is the extremal Myers-Perry black holes. What I have here in red is the onset curve of the superradiant instability. That is, so Myers-Perry black holes exist above the blue curve. This is the Myers-Perry black holes where the superradiant instability kicks in. This dashed curve is the perturbative result. As you see, it starts deviating again. Quite importantly, the onset of the superradiant instability at a certain point meets the extremality curve. Okay, and there it stops. So black holes, Myers-Perry black holes that would be to the right of this plot, they would be, in principle, eventually stable to the superradiant instability. On this right-hand side plot, what I'm plotting is the same thing as here, but I'm extending to larger values of the energy and the angular momentum. And what we see is that here, this blue curve is the extremal Myers-Perry curve. And here, I'm just plotting the boson star curve. And what we see is that this boson star, when I extend it to larger values of the angular momentum, it does cross at a certain point the blue curve at this point B. So for a given angular momentum at a certain point, it can have lower energy. It also develops cusps. So we have a first arm here, a second arm here that is here that we don't see very well, much like what was happening in the soliton case. As we move along the soliton curve, like in the charge case, what is happening is that the curvature invariant is growing large. Again, like in the soliton case, we expect infinite oscillations like or cusps. And I think that I have said what I had to say here. OK, this is the plot where I plot with the phase diagram, with the full phase diagram of solutions that we can have associated with this system. So let me start by, so here I have the energy. Again, I'm plotting the energy with respect to the lower branch of boson stars in this case. So this is the purple curve, the boson star curve. And then it would have cusps here. OK. In order to see better the plot, we need to do this difference. Here, this blue curve is the extreme Myers-Perry curve. Point B is this point B where the blue curve intersects the boson star. It's over there. Point C, this red curve, is the onset superradiant instability curve that meets the extremality at point C over there, this red curve. Myers-Perry black holes always exist above the blue curve. Okay. Now, what we do have here at the red curves are airy black holes with constant R2. R2, remember, was the size of the S2 that I'm using to parameterize my solution. The size of the S1 is decreasing as we move along this curve. This curve has bigger R2 than this one bigger than this one. Then here in green, I'm plotting curves of constant angular velocity at the horizon. And the angular velocity is decreasing when we move in this direction. OK, now, important things to say. Notice that whenever I have two red curves, for example, this one crossing with the other red curve, I really have non-uniqueness here. Because here, they exactly have the same mass and charge. But then if you plot the entropy, you will see that the two solutions have different, clearly different entropy. OK? Let me also tell you that.
Which one has it higher?
It should be this one, no? Because the three-dimensional plot is something like.
Three-dimensional plot is a bit difficult.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I will not even show you. Now, quite importantly, close to the superradiant merger, the entropy of the Myers-Perry black hole is always smaller than the entropy of the Airy black hole. Okay, so which tells us that the phase transition at the merger is second-order phase transition. However, for Airy black holes that are above a certain critical angular momentum, what happens is that the Myers-Perry black holes have larger entropy for the same charge than the airy black holes. So the phase transition is first order. There is no connection between these airy black holes in this regime. There is no connection between these airy black holes and the superweighting disability of the Meyer-Starry black holes. And I would say that this is, not to delay further, this is the key point. So let me just say, in a three-dimensional plot, what would happen is that the airy black holes would be a two-dimensional surface that on one end is bounded by the merger superradiant line, on the other end is bounded by the boson star line. But above a critical angular momentum, what happens is that it is still bounded by the boson star, but then it is bounded by this extremal green line. In this extremal green line, what is happening? The Kretschmann invariant is keeping finite, but the tidal forces are becoming infinite. So this is still an extremal, and the temperature is going to zero. So it's an extremal but still singular solution, but due to the tidal forces. Okay, the only thing that I would like to stress is that all our airy black holes have so these airy black holes that we construct could naively be seen as the endpoint of the superradiant instability if the m equals 1 mode was the only unstable mode in the solution. But we know that the higher m modes will also kick in the system. And we also know that all these airy black holes that we construct, they have angular velocity bigger than 1. This means, this was proven by Harvey Riehl and Stephen Hawking, that these black holes, we should expect them to be superradiantly unstable themselves. So they can just be metastable states at most during a time evolution. So now the question is, what is the endpoint of the rotating superradiance instability? And we don't know really much about it. And there isn't much we can predict, except that eventually, what we expect is that as higher and higher m's will kick in, you will have stop right now. Okay. it will develop higher and higher m's, you know, and so you will have higher and higher lobes in your solution. Of course, then we could also say that maybe there is also a competition between the superradiant and the thermal instabilities. But okay, I stop here. Thank you.
The time, and because we all need coffee, I think we shall reconvene here at 10:35.